Cheer on some of the wildest professional taggers.
You see how happy I am right now?
Or root for the amateurs with your whole family.
Oh, my God.
It's time to play some tag.
Wow, thanks, Sparkle. Wait, this isn't you?
That's the old Sparkle.
All right, get your worthless butts in the van. Come on, let's go, go, go!
Ultimate Tag premieres Wednesday after the Masked Singer season finale on Fox.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 303 for the week of May 18th, 2020. I am fan-made sign for a show no one has seen yet, David T. Cole, and tag you're it, Free Walker, Sarah D. Bunting.
Also not a thing. Tag you're it, human Ms. Pac-Man, Tara Ariano.
Oh, I'm gonna get you, ghost. Tag you're it, Mr. Microphone, Daniel McEachern.
I'm protected by the First Amendment, and you're gonna need some first aid. Tag you're it. Oh, crap.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Joining us is our friend Daniel McEachern. Hello, Danny.
Yay!
Hi, everybody.
We're here to talk about Ultimate Tag. The premise of Ultimate Tag is it's tag, but it's the ultimate version of it. It's tag, the playground game, on a very extreme course inside what looks like the same studio where they probably shoot Lego Masters, frankly.
Inside some El Segundo former laser tag warehouse.
No doubt. Yes. They have various different courses. They've remixed the game in various ways. You got dodge tag, chase tag, dome tag, revenge tag, the showdown, which is like one-on-one tag. And then they also have a group of professional, they say, taggers, which I guess they are in that they get paid by the show. But they are all in the style of American Gladiators. They have personas that are to greater and less degrees thought out and sort of characters and costumes and catchphrases and so on. And their job is to run through the maze, and then they are the taggers and they're supposed to catch the contestants, and who all have little sort of hangy, flaggy things on their uniforms. And when you get one yanked off you, then you're tagged.
Flag football stuff.
Exactly. It's not a contact game. So I was very excited about this when the screeners first landed in my inbox. And after I basically bullied Sarah and David to making this our lead topic this week, we wanted to have you on, Danny, as our guest, since you had joined us last year for our discussion of the Holy Moly season premiere. Let's start with the inevitable question. How would you say this dumb sports adjacent gimmick show stacks up to Holy Moly?
I think it makes Holy Moly look like Masterpiece Theater.
Yes. Thank you.
It's funny that you mentioned Holy Moly because, yes, I was on last summer to talk about Holy Moly, and it was literally an hour before you emailed me to ask about doing the show that I learned that Holy Moly was coming back. And I said, oh, maybe I'll go back on Extra Hot Great. And then I get an email from you saying, would you like to come on and discuss Ultimate Tag? And I said, yes. So I made some notes, mostly questions. One question is, do the producers expect us to believe Ultimate Tag is something that exists outside the show?
Right.
Did they brainstorm any more interesting catchphrases for J.J. Watt and then settle on, it's time to play some tag? Do all three Watt brothers really need to be here?
There's a fourth Watt brother that lives inside the walls that didn't invite.
I think after the success of Peyton Manning on Saturday Night Live, people have been looking for another quote-unquote funny football player. And
right.
I guess J.J. Watt is slightly more personable than your average football player, but I think then it's diminishing returns with the three of them. I watched the first episode, and I don't think the other two contributed more than at one point one of them farted, and J.J. Watt pointed out that he farted, and the third brother confirmed that he farted. That was the extent of what they brought to the show. Like, I mean, Holy Moly, they don't have athletes as the host. They have a comedian who can think on his feet and make quips, and they have an actual sports commentator to describe the action. Yeah, Holy Moly was a dumb show, but I feel like Ultimate Tag is a dumb show, but it's also treating its audience like the audience is dumb, and there's a difference there, and I did not enjoy this very much at all. There was, I mean, a lot of the athleticism was really cool to watch. The taggers, like right off the bat, there's a guy named The Flow. All the nicknames and stuff are really dumb. We can get into that later. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these guys are free runners and parkour athletes, and to watch them rip around and like swing on the bars and hop over the railings and that kind of thing, that was great. I think I'd just rather watch them race through some sort of obstacle course.
Yeah, or just watch the beginning of Casino Royale again.
Yeah.
The parkour.
Yeah. That's what it made me think of. Just so much of this seemed like first draft. Like there are problems with I had with the actual tag formats. Like the first one is called Chase Tag, where the three contestants all go into what's called the arena, and then taggers are released into the arena like the Rancor in Return of the Jedi. And
exactly like that. Including that one Watt brother that has three sets of breasts.
And the goal is, I mean, the winner is going to be the person who outlasts the tagger the longest. But since all the contestants go into the arena at the same time, it just sort of seems like it's more of a function of who the tagger decides to go after first.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a clock running while this happens, and the tagger, he gets the first guy, and he's strutting around and flexing. The audience is cheering. And meanwhile, the clock's still running. And then a few seconds later, they go, okay, here comes another tagger. And so, yeah, it's like you said, playtesting, I think, was minimal, if done at all. And there were a lot of details like that throughout the whole episode that left me feeling like this is not going to be as enjoyable as Holy Moly is, last summer I watched all of Holy Moly. This is probably the extent of Ultimate Tag that I'm going to watch.
Yeah. The other one I thought was like, was the last one, which is called what do they call
the showdown.
So you get one contestant, he has to run through normal stuff, the horses and the, you know, duck under this, go through a tube stuff. And then at the end of it, there's like this big pyramid they have to scale. And there's one guy that one tagger works the floor, one tagger works the pyramid. If you get tagged, if they pull the flag on the bottom, you get 5 second penalty. And then if again at the top, you get another 5 second penalty. Just run it. The only way they didn't get tagged is if the tagger slipped, something happened to the tagger outside of what you did as a runner. So just like pretend they're not there.
Right. Assume you're going to have those
10 seconds and just go for it. Because every sidestep you do, everything you try to do to eliminate the tagger, like they're just waiting for you at the end.
Yeah.
Like you remember when you were playing tag in school? And there's just this guy waiting for you at the end or playing hide and seek.
Yeah,
and like, base. He's just waiting for you back at home base. And like, oh, well, fuck, what am I going to do now?
Right.
Nothing, I guess, you know, like it was like that. And so a lot of the games, even though in the moment there's a lot of dynamic running and jumping and parkouring, like there was no strategy involved and needed both things to be compelling, probably because it just seemed like these rules that they're making don't actually affect the outcome.
Right.
And they don't show the clock the whole time. Like it just obviously, like you said, was not tested beforehand. And once you've seen the taggers enter the floor and just be very light and balletic and just like flying through the air, that's the main draw of it for me. And after that, it's like, well, I don't care about the outcome, neither does the audience, despite their signs, as mentioned up top. So, I just think that this was not thought through and they were sort of too far into it to go back. And also force your taggers to, if their names don't work, like change it for them. Like, what is La Flair? Like, it is I, Blork. And then, like, a blue flame shoots out. Like, what are you?
It's
like,
a fork. It's a balloon. Blork.
Yeah.
Yeah, their personas don't have any effect on the gameplay at all. They've got, oh, she's the boss, and you better watch out, because she's going to rip your ribbon off your shirt. And then here comes the caveman, and he's got, you know, like, a loincloth on. And what does the caveman do? He's gonna rip a ribbon off your shirt and so.
Yeah.
What would they be if they were tag specific names? Because they're just wrestling names.
Flag the Ripper.
Okay, Jack the Ripper, good one. Yeah.
They strut around and they flex like it's wrestling, but then you're watching, you're going, it's just tag. You just tagged a guy. That's all this is.
Well,
Tagger jeans. Wait, that's Tagger jeans.
Let me say, I'm the only one who watched all the three screeners that were provided, I believe. So I'll say there's one tagger whose name is Horse, who comes up in the second episode. Horse is an extreme stuntman. Horse is the only one who seems to have like fully committed to making this a character. Like he struts around and like neighs and like kicks his feet like he's kicking the dirt like a horse. And he's so far ahead. Like I have in my notes in all caps, Horse is bringing the right energy to this. And I feel like he's the only one who did. Like truly, either everyone should be on Horse's level or you got to get Horse out of there because he is showing up everybody else. Like when you have some, when someone else is just like Iron Giantess, like, okay, being tall is not a persona. Like that's not enough.
And her costume like wasn't like heavy metal or have metal parts. You know what I mean? It didn't remind you of Iron Maiden.
Yes.
Which was the font they used.
She didn't say no following.
It was very just throw it away stuff. Mm-hmm. And my favorite part of the taggers were like, they all have these, like the redhead is Flame. You know, the Iron Giantess is just like a big lady. There's one that's the Patriot guy is, what is he? He's not Right Stuff.
Big Deal.
Big Deal. That's
yeah,
right.
Big yeah, deal. Big the Deal. The cheerleader guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I wrote down Big Lots and was like about to cross it out of my notes. And I was like, no, that's about where we are with this.
There's a guy that looks like Napoleon Dynamite called the Nerd.
No, he's just called Geek.
Geek? Oh, okay.
Geek, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I had Weird Al for that, but we will accept Napoleon Dynamite.
I had Weird Al crossed with Andy Samberg.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
All
yeah.
these things yep, yep. apply. My favorite one, though, was this guy named Beach Boy. Beach Boy. He's just like, it's like, is that intimidating to who?
Right.
Like crabs? I don't know. Well, like, but the best part of Beach Boy, is he? Uh-huh. But then I looked at his bio. The dude's from Edmonton.
Come on.
He is.
Edmonton Beach.
Yeah. I like the one who was La Flair. Because at first I was like, no, it's L.A. Flair, which it's not. And then it's like, it's La Flair, L.A. Like, no, dude, if you're trying to do a French thing, you're La Flair. You are a guy. Be consistent with your language. Anyway, since we're talking about taggers, I challenged us all to come up with our own tagger personas, so we might as well do that now. I will start, because this was my stupid idea. My tagger persona is Thighmaster. Here's why. I am famously in terrible shape, but when I actually put any effort into exercising my quads, Dave can attest to this, are the first thing that actually develop any musculature. So I wouldn't try to be fast. I would be the person close to the plunger in the showdown. I'd be the person on the pyramid that's just basically standing there like in goal. And then I would just try and clamp the contestant in my thighs to pull their flags off. My costume obviously would be all black with angry red thighs to emphasize the thighs. And my catchphrases would be, "You look fit to be thighed."
Okay.
Yeah, you're already like 7 miles ahead of anyone else on the show.
Yep.
Dave.
First of all, I just want to say about all these personas, when they do the graphics, and this may be, I may be speaking to like 3 people that are listening, but just know that all the graphic for all the characters took about 10 minutes each, and they're all designed with Kai Power Tools from 1992. I'll link in the show notes some examples of Kai Power Tools, but boy, oh boy, minimal effort. My persona, this is all because I just finished reading Dune, because I thought maybe I should read Dune, which is...
Were you correct? Should you have?
No.
Okay.
I don't understand why this is such a thing. Okay. This is a different podcast, but no, I was not impressed with Dune. Anyways, my guy is called The Maker, and The Maker is a name for those big sandworms, which is the one thing anybody knows about Dune, the big sandworm things. So like the sandworms of Dune, I lie in the ground and just wait for the telltale pitter-patter of contestant feet to come near me. Then I rise up and I take the tag like a sandworm and go back down into the depths and, you know, make spice or whatever they do.
Nice.
Yeah. The Maker.
Love it.
Yeah. And then The Maker is like, it's textured. Like when this comes up, it says The Maker. And then The Maker is like filled with sand, but then the sand for some reason also has a very sharp bezel all around it from Kai Power Tools. So like, why does sand have a bezel? Doesn't matter. Kai Power Tools.
Danny.
Well, I stuck with the Mr. Microphone persona from the show intro. I'm a journalist themed tagger who's going to put you on the record and on your ass. I have an old timey fedora with a card that says press stuck in the hat band. And I wear one of those photographer vests that have all the pockets, except they're all filled with M&Ms, and it's not going to have any effect on gameplay because the hat's going to go flying off and the M&Ms are going to spill everywhere. But I will have a microphone, a corded microphone, which is a relic from an earlier age. But for the purposes of this game, I'll use it to rope the contestants in and pull them in and tag them.
Love it.
And then after I tag you, I'm going to flex. I'm going to point at you. And because I'm Mr. Microphone, I'm going to say, "I'll be back to kick your ass later."
Also would have accepted hot scoop.
Sarah.
This just in, breaking your legs.
Well, my persona is a variation on my stripper persona, Cinnamon Bunting. This one is hot cross bunting. She's hot. She's cross. her hair is in Princess Leia rolls, obviously. Wearing a brown pleather outfit with white icing stripes on it, as befits my brand of really disliking to run. I will be standing next to the base, eating a cinnamon roll and saying extremely clever things such as, "It'd be pretty sweet if you could outrun me, but I'm going to eat you for breakfast." And then I'd be canceled correctly.
Nice. I will also say, having been as the only one who watched all the screeners, the premiere is weirdly the weakest of the three episodes for a couple of reasons. First, Revenge Tag happens off screen. We get like a recap of it. The women play it.
Yeah, what the hell?
And that's Argus.
I thought that was odd too.
Yeah, that which happened on Holy Moly a lot in season one as well. There would be like holes would be played off screen and they would just say what happened. But Revenge Tag is arguably the best game on the show, in my opinion, where you get one runner, one tagger, and then they have these pillars where if the contestant goes and hits them and activates them, then they reverse. And so then the contestant becomes the chaser. They can go after the tagger. This is human Pac-Man. Like, it's right. The best one. It's so much more fun to watch. Why would you not put that in the first episode? Second, all the contestants have pretty serious athletic backgrounds. Two people in the first episode, as we saw, were on national sports teams for handball and track. But the third episode features a semi-professional flag football player. And without spoiling everything, she is very well suited to play this game. Like, obviously, these are exactly the skills that you would need to do it. So, like, either of those would have been a better introduction to the show than the actual first episode. And since there isn't, as far as we can see, any kind of tournament aspect, I don't know why they wouldn't have put one of those first, because I thought the first episode was kind of blah.
Well, I think in a nutshell, you wanted it to be Holy Moly, but it's really more for the crowd that enjoys American Ninja Warrior.
For sure.
That sort of thing.
Yes.
It's not enjoy other people's pain sort of show, which is, you know, come on. We were all hoping that would have been the case.
Yep, 100%.
It is time to go around the dial talking about things we've watched on TV lately, starting with Tara Ariano.
I got three.
Wow.
Yeah. First, Snowpiercer on TNT. Holy moly. Maybe you were excited about this because you saw the Bong Joon-ho movie when it came out a few years ago and thought the show would be interesting. It's not. It is the same premise as the movie, except in the first episode, we find out that someone has been murdered. They know one of the people in the stowaway class, which is they call themselves tailies, like on Lost, used to be a homicide detective in his previous life. He's played by David Diggs. And so they want him to solve the murder. They took Snowpiercer and made it a cop show. What? Why would you do that?
Jeez.
Why? So, It's very strange. It went through a whole like development hell process where like the original guy who was going to make it, I think his name was Josh Friedman. He was the Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles guy. He did a whole treatment and then he got fired and he got replaced by Graham Manson, who's the creator of Orphan Black. And they have snuck in all kinds of Canadian-osities, including in one of the early episodes, they're like someone, or Jennifer Connelly makes a reference to refilling your Gravol prescription. So I discovered when I tweeted about this, like no one on set was like, that's a Canadian thing. And then I found out Canadians don't know it's Canadian and Americans just didn't know what it was. So for your information, in case you're ever traveling again, Gravol and Dramamine are the same thing in different countries. So FYI, that's why that is a joke in there that some is going to not work, I guess, or it just sounds futury. So maybe it will. I don't know. Whatever. I reviewed it for Primetimer, but don't watch it. It's really dumb and bad. Watch the movie, which is on Netflix. Instead, I would like to talk about two light, lovely shows that ended their seasons this week and that I'm really going to miss because they have been a balm to me in these dark times. One is Katie Keene on the CW. I talked about it when it premiered, so I won't restate the premise, but I really loved being immersed in a fairy tale version of New York where artists who don't come from wealth can still follow their dreams and afford to live there while doing it. Really far uptown, but still. Another character from Riverdale showed up in the season finale. Katie Keene, of course, is a spinoff of Riverdale. So if you are a person who watches that show, but has not been watching Katie Keene because it isn't all about murder cults or whatever happens on Riverdale, baby, check it out. As of this recording, Katie Keene has still not been renewed. If it gets canceled, I will be very sad. Fortunately, there is no danger of losing Call the Midwife anytime soon. Just finished airing its 9th season on PBS. It's already been renewed through season 11. This season hasn't really had as strong a through line as others have, like storylines about thalidomide or contraception, although it did start with a diphtheria outbreak that required several families to quarantine. So that was timely. Yikes. But lurking in the background has been the threat that the sisters and the midwives are going to get evicted from their property so that it can be developed. Also very timely. And this has already happened in a previous season, and I imagine is based on real stories that happened to community organizations in the East End in the mid-century as the council cleared out the old tenements and built more high-rises. And the other element threatening the work of the order is that the increase in the availability of contraception is starting to be reflected in the lower birth rates, so that the nurses and midwives are noticeably not serving as many expectant mothers as they used to. I mean, not noticeable to us because there's only one or two mothers that they really focus on in an episode, but that it would go down enough for their, you know, it's not enough that there wouldn't be a show, but as a reflection of the era, it's interesting. But in the finale, Sister Julianne, who put off even telling anyone about the threat in the hopes that it would pass, finds out that the council is cutting Nanatus House funding and raising rent on the building that they occupy on top of the threat of demolition. And again, we know about the two seasons that are definitely still to come, but that doesn't lessen the passionate speech Trixie gives the council to appeal the decision. So she talks about the annual reports that the local medical board issues and how it states the numbers of babies that are born, but not their names, whereas the Nanatans know exactly how many Marys, Elizabeths, Elsies, Joneses, Smiths, Patels, and Zhangs they've served and what occupations support all the households they come from. And it builds to this crescendo. Dave, please play clip one.
We know because their names are in our records. Babies are not statistics at Nanatus House. We know when they are wanted or unwanted, whether they are cherished or deprived. We see when they're in with a chance in life or stand no chance at all. We value every infant and every mother equally. We are part of their world, and they are part of ours, because that is what happens when you enter people's homes. In almost 30 years of annual reports, you have never once mentioned the contribution Nanatus House has made to people's lives in Poplar. You have never once called us by our name. But do not think we won't be missed if you wipe us out completely.
Nurses! Sob. The season ends with a Guy Fawkes Day celebration, and while sometimes old Jenny's narration is a little great greeting card generic, this one got me. Clip two.
The seasons will always turn. The clouds will gather and the cold will come. We will survive them. We will grow regardless of the weather. We will know wonder where there has been despair. There will be happiness. And we will remember it. There will be friendships which we won't forget. Love is the constant whereby we endure all winters and all storms. It is the climate in which all things can thrive.
Richie, come back!
Welcome the darkness. Embrace it as a canopy from which the stars can hang. For there are always stars when we are where we ought to be, amongst the faces we love best. Each with our place, each with our purpose, as fixed and familiar as the constellations. The darkness is beautiful, for how else can we shine?
It was a good season, so you should check it out. I've listened to this clip four times today. It still gets me. Sigh. I am recovering.
I just finished the 5th season, which is some dark shit.
Yeah.
Like, it is really bad. And we realized that we were rounding the clubhouse turn, basically. It was like, okay, well, then we'll have the Christmas special. And like, what else could happen? Sister Evangelina. Like, I was angrily crying into my noodles. So mad. But it, I mean, it's such a good show. Dan's always like, yeah, I guess we can watch that. And then he's like riveted to it. So yeah, looking forward to catching up maybe one day.
It's lovely. It's been a very good season. So I recommend that and Katie Keene if you've been in a dark place yourself. They will make you feel better. Although, as Sarah says, dark stuff happens on Call the Midwife way more on Katie than on Katie Keene. For my plug, I got to interview Rich Summer a couple of weeks ago about Run and Glow and Mad Men, and it was super fun. He was lovely and really easy to talk to, and that is up on Primetimer. We'll link it in the show notes.
Danny McEckert.
Like a lot of people around North America, on Monday we watched in my household the last couple episodes of Last Dance, the Netflix 10-part documentary about the Chicago Bulls' 1998 title run, which is the last championship that they won, Michael Jordan's last championship. It was interesting to watch something. I think this is the first time that I've watched a documentary that I really remember everything that is discussed in the documentary. It took me a while to understand that this was something that had happened such a long time ago, because there's a part of my brain that still files everything that happened after I graduated from university under current events and not history. And so I was like, 98, that was just 19, 20, 21. Holy crap, that was 22 years ago, like literally half my life ago. So it was fun to relive that. It was fun to watch with my wife and daughter. My wife, a friend of the show, Alex Collins.
That was presumptive.
What's that? You
presume, sir.
She's been on the show.
Yeah, it's not his place to say who our friends at the show are.
I wondered about it before I said it. Anyway, she doesn't watch live, or she doesn't watch televised sports, loves live sports, and watch it with my daughter, who only knows Michael Jordan as, you know, a legendary basketball player. And so they don't know the details of what happened with the Bulls title runs. And so it gave me the experience. It was kind of like watching a favorite movie with a couple of people who've never seen it before. And I had to be careful not to say things like, oh, this is where Jordan hits that shot against Cleveland, or, you know, well, this is where Jordan scores 63 against the Celtics, because they don't know what's going to happen. I thought the documentary did a really good job. Like, each episode inched closer during the season towards the 98 title, while flashing back to Jordan in high school, Jordan in college, Jordan in his early career. There have been some criticisms about the documentary, because Michael Jordan had apparently complete control over it. A lot of times the documentary comes off like a job interview where the person asks you a question like, what's your biggest weakness? And you get to say, well, you know, I just care too much. So this documentary really is another one of those that connects the fact that Michael Jordan is a huge dick with the fact that Michael Jordan was the greatest basketball player who ever lived, and then concludes that Michael Jordan was the biggest, greatest basketball player who ever lived because he was a huge dick. And it ought to be clear to everybody at this point that he was a huge dick because he was the greatest basketball player who ever lived, and not the other way around. In a lot of documentaries like this, especially ones that revolve around a championship, and I'm not saying this documentary should have done what other documentaries do, but this revolved around a particular championship. And there are no shots of Jordan interacting with any of his teammates. They don't get together to go to the stadium and look at the banner and relive some of the moments together. They're all interviewed individually in their houses. And the Michael Jordan's teammates, there's a lot of guarded language about him. They talk about him being a bully, being a dick. I wish I could find something where there's a little bit more discussion of that idea that, you know, you don't have to goad your teammates to the point of them punching you in practice for you to lead them to championships. Team sports, there's countless examples in basketball and hockey and football and baseball, all kinds of sports, players who led their teams to greatness without, you know, without alienating their own teammates 20 years down the road. Tim Duncan's got 5 rings. Everybody loves Tim Duncan. I know it's not always fair to watch something and say, oh, they should have done this with this. I mean, there are constraints on the filmmakers. I'm sure that they couldn't have done everything that they wanted with.
I think they couldn't have done it, period, if they hadn't agreed to his. I think that it did benefit from there being fuck all else to watch sports-wise right now. Like, unless you're going to, you know, televise your dice baseball games via Zoom with your dad, which I have considered. It's that dire.
We're watching marbles right now, so.
Yeah, I mean, so, but I do think it was well made. And I think that they did manage to put the idea across in spite of Jordan's involvement, or, you know, maybe because of it. Like, I don't think this is someone who doesn't know that he is feared and not loved. And I just don't think he gives a shit because he's Michael Jordan, which, fair enough.
Hitler mustache? Sure. Michael Jordan.
He's worth a couple $1 billion. And I mean, for people who weren't around at the time, like the demands on his name and his time and his celebrity were, anybody would have to put up the walls that he put up to have to survive all that.
Yeah. Plus, you know, what happened with his dad and all that. And it's like, maybe you just, after you've watched enough 30 for 30s, you learn to read between the lines pretty effortlessly. I did think their chyrons were clever. Like Barack Obama comes up and it's like former Chicago resident Barack Obama. Like it was wittily done. And it was the series that we needed right now since we didn't get an NBA postseason. But yeah, I think it almost was at its strongest when it was going down little side streets off the main topic to talk to you about like how Scottie Pippen got to a four-year college and how Phil Jackson managed Dennis Rodman being a weirdo. And then ESPN aired the Dennis Rodman 30 for 30. And it's like, okay, this is smartly positioned. But yeah, I mean, it's not... There have been a lot of think pieces about like, well, Michael Jordan controlled it. So how true is any of this? Like, well, it's, you know, a documentary series, not a court proceeding.
And it's a documentary series about a basketball team. It's not the Pentagon Papers. It's right.
Yeah, like, well, it's... exactly. Also, he's a cock stipulated. So if you need him to admit it on camera and then start crying, maybe ESPN isn't the channel for you. I don't know.
I coach basketball, and there are a couple times, and my daughter plays basketball, and so there would be a couple times where we talk about some of the things that were being discussed on the documentary, and there'd be things said like, oh, well, sure, he was a jerk, but Jordan never asked anything of his teammates that he wasn't willing to do himself. That's not extraordinary. That's baseline for being part of a team, right? So there were teachable moments in the documentary, I felt, at least for me and my daughter.
Nice.
For my plug, if you are within the sound of my voice and you live in Newfoundland and Labrador and you are looking for the most up-to-date information on how the coronavirus is affecting us, you can go to cbc.ca/NL and we'll fill you in.
Very good.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I have quit Killing Eve at last. Is anyone here still watching it?
Yeah, yep. We are.
Okay. I give you permission to stop if that's something you've been considering doing. Here's why. I think we actually thought we had quit it after season two, which was not bad, but also it was like, well, there's so much TV. Now, although it feels, I don't know what the word is, like flouting the gods, I guess, to quit scripted TV while there still is some, because we're going to run out in like 12 minutes. We just hadn't been in a big hurry to watch it this season. I was sort of like, all right, it's got one episode to impress me and then I'm kicking it off. And then Harriet Walter was on it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I love Harriet Walter. So you get two episodes. But I don't know, like we let the most recent two stack up on the DVR. That's what passes for a stack in these times, two episodes. And it just sort of showcased every way in which the show itself has seemingly forgotten what made it good and fresh. There's a whole episode on Villanelle's like Freudian field trip, which nobody asked for, ends in a killing spree we're supposed to think is cute and is not. There's 42 minutes of shitting on small towns in Eastern Europe that is both condescending and baffling. I'm not small Eastern European towns lawyer over here, but this is not entertaining. Dung flinging. Hilarious. What? Villanelle's sad, pitiable backstory is not the play here. Chaotic evil is interesting only if it is chaotic. And that's a whole episode. And then we're back into the main story. But because so much time has already been spent either eye-fucking Villanelle's hideous couture or playing emo songs while she and Eve stare longingly through montages at not each other because they're not in the same country, we don't remember where we are with the 12 storyline. Nico is apparently alive. Like, what is this Spinal Tap drummer bullshit they're doing with him? Kill him or write him off. The one. He doesn't want to be married to Eve anymore. He is afraid of her. This is not fun to watch. I mean, there's just a tonal whiplash here that is feeling like a waste of my time. And then the end of the last episode was like, oh, now this kid that we don't care about, now we're supposed to care about this. This is an extremely talented cast. The first season was a lot of fun. I don't think anyone currently working on the show remembers why it was interesting. And you know who doesn't need an Emmy reel is Jodie Comer. Like, what are we doing here? So I just looked at Dan and I was like, I'll keep recording it for you if you want, but I'm out. And he's like, no, I was on Twitter and not paying attention in the last 20 minutes, so let's just kill it. So we quit.
The one thing in this season you didn't mention that I don't get is the Fiona Shaw storyline, which just seems to be just on a repeat cycle every episode.
You know, yes, that too. Mopey,
suddenly angry, on repeat since spoiler, something happened to her son. Go there if you want to, but go somewhere when you get there.
Yeah.
Because right now they've just been driving in circles on the roundabout.
Yeah, yeah. That's like, how many versions of this conversation with her daughter that she doesn't like are we going to have?
No, it's true. That storyline is like, considering it's what happened in the premiere, it's like there feels like there's been no urgency about that at all. Like it's just dropped for days and episodes at a time. We watched the episode 7 screener, so I mean we're so close to the end. I'll probably watch the finale, honestly, mostly because I'm counting on there being an episode, or like at least one scene between Harriet Walter and Fiona Shaw. And if there isn't, I might quit the show, because why do you cast both of these actresses and then not figure out something for them to do opposite each other? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Like, give them a spinoff. I'd watch that. I'd watch them just like driving silently through English countryside.
Yeah.
Whatever this is, I don't have time for somehow. So
no, this is
that's it.
Killing Eve is like Homeland in that, like, the it should have been a one season show, and it wasn't, and now we're still here. So,
well, Homeland, I watched every episode of, and it's finally over. But I am not going to make that mistake with things anymore.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah.
For my plug, speaking of fluffy but worthwhile entertainment, me and Smooth Joey Apollo, Mr. Joe Reed, were reminiscing about soap operas for Primetimer.com. There will be a link in the show notes, but there was, as you're listening to this, a special on ABC last night about, like, it's hosted by Andy Cohen, and it's basically like soaps, they're great, and, you know, blowing gold up the culo of daytime dramas. And Joe and I were like, really? And then we were like, actually, we're completely here for that, and started reminiscing about all the things we used to watch with our grandmas. Anyway, it was fun to write and think about, and that's on primetimer.com.
Yay.
Holy Moly is back, as we said earlier in the podcast, and they actually went and tinkered a lot with the formula, and I think maybe all their decisions were the right ones.
100%.
So to start off, there's a lot less matches. They cut one third right out from the start.
Yes.
So you see more of the matches that are happening. And that was a smart play, because when they just fast forward through something in season one, it was like, well, why bother at all? And they've redesigned the course. Everything is new, although it's pretty funny to see what they Legoized from old holes and reused. You know, like, this is not a volcano anymore, but sure looks like the volcano from season one. Except now there's like a Plinko kind of element to it, which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Rob Riggle's having a lot of fun this season. The best part of season one, episode one, is that there is a hole that really seems like it didn't get finished. And he bags on it so hard and for so long, like at ABC's expense. It's kind of funny. It's refreshing to see that.
Well, he's right. It's the theme of it is like, it's a beaver dam.
Yeah.
So it's like, why is this the only hazard? Why is this the only hole on the course that does not have water in it?
Yeah.
Like, honestly.
Yeah, no, it's true. They ditched that one where you either get Curry or the robot. I suspect because Curry's not available, because they actually replaced him with a cartoon in this
it's now
season.
Animated
He's now
Steph
animated
Curry.
Steph Curry.
Wow.
So he just phoned in his role. Instead of the robot one, they have one where I don't know if it's going to be him every week, but they had John Lovitz. He'll chip your ball towards the hole with an eye patch. And then the other person, he wears two eye patches and does the same thing.
On both eyes.
Yeah. So that's good because with the robot, it always landed in the same place. But with John Lovitz, that chip, you don't know where it's going. Stem to stern, an improvement. You know, if you liked Holy Moly season one, they just did a better job of focusing on what it made it good and cut out most of what made it kind of tedious at points, except they still got Steph Curry with this stupid deep thought stuff in the middle.
Yeah, but they I would say the biggest and most important change they made was they ratcheted up the potential for physical harm mm-hmm. on every hole.
More people
that's excellent.
Consistently get hurt in Holy Moly than Ultimate Tag.
Definitely. Yes.
And why is that? Hey, I'm here for it. Sure. But like, if you said, what do you think's got the most human pain going on? We got all this obstacle course with people playing tag at high speeds with parkour movements or people playing mini putt. Mm-hmm. Like, remember the windmill hole from mm-hmm. season one? Well, they slightly tweaked take on it, except the windmill has to be going double speed and it went.
Well, they added a blade. It used to have four blades. Right. Now it has five. So it's harder to get through.
One person actually bails on it and just jumps in the water.
She psychs herself out so much that she's just like, forget it, and jumps in the water. Yeah, yeah, it's amazing.
Anyways, if you like Holy really Moly good. Season one, you'll like Holy Moly season two. They made some good choices.
Yeah, it's great. Thursday nights on ABC.
Coming up on this podcast and things related to it on the next Extra Extra Hot Great, it is the Goop Lab Lab.
Oh, boy.
Yes, it is my foresight. This is part one. I've decided to do three parts because I needed to do a deep dive on two episodes at a time rather than try
That's what
to
she
tackle
said
all six
in a
at
future
once.
Episode.
Of course, that is available on our Patreon feed. And just to mention it, because once in a while we get a very generous Patreon donation. And then sometimes I see that they go back in a day later and put that donation down to what I would say is a normal and generous donation. So I just want to say Patreon, the way it works is you donate a small amount each month. It's not like a one-time tip jar. Because sometimes I think people think it's that and they'll give us like $20 or something. I'm like, whoa, that is too much. Like, I thank you very much for your support, but $20 a month seems like an awful lot. And they'll be like, oh, they'll realize. And then they'll drop down to like the $2 or $5 or whatever. So
to be clear, we don't tell them that. But when they do edit it on their own, we understand why.
We are not offended.
Some people are rich. We get that. And if they want
to
give us $20
a month,
that's
in the universe. So somebody like doesn't make a donation, goes on a worldwide trip, comes back and they spent $100 on this podcast and they only wanted to give $10.
Sure.
That's all. So that's that.
Patreon.com/extrahot.
Thank you very much. Coming up on which is hopefully going to be the last quarantine helper, but probably not until the killer second wave hits, is You Must Also Remember This, which is what facets of TV history would make for a great episode of that podcast. You Must Remember This. Mm-hmm. So we all pick something that seemed to have an interesting storied past and pitched our episode of that podcast, TVized. And then on the next Extra Hot Great Prime, we welcome Vanity Fair's Sonia Saraya to discuss the second season of Homecoming.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Mary. She calls it characters who stank up the actor. And she writes, what is a TV character who you found so annoying, distasteful, etc., that you couldn't stand the actor in any role after that? I'll go first. This one came to me immediately. And that character is Dwight Schrute. I really liked Rainn Wilson a lot. I was the one who liked him on 6 Feet Under when he played Arthur. I know people, his whole thing was that people thought he was creepy. And that's how he was portrayed. I actually thought he was really sweet. I had tender feelings toward him in that role. He was like such a misguided weirdo that, you know, I kind of liked him and Ruth and whatever was going on between them. But even though I can tell he's trying to stretch, to me, he was just hipster Dwight in Juno. He was space Dwight on Discovery. Now he's therapist Dwight on Mom. And looking him up, I found out the American Utopia remake is still happening. I don't know where for.
Really?
Huh. Yeah. Apparently, David Fincher is not attached anymore. It's Gillian Flynn who did Gone Girl.
Not the reality show, in case anybody's wondering. There's a drama called Utopia.
Yes, which we've talked about on the podcast a million billion years ago. Anyway, that's still happening. He's in it. Mm. Currently, it's in post-production. I assume he's the weird author guy.
Yeah.
So, author Dwight, still to come. I don't know about this, but anyway, that's my pick. Dwight Schrute ruined Rainn Wilson forever. Sarah?
It
it took me actually a shocking amount of time, which is to say 7 minutes, to get to my eventual destination, that I was like, well, it took me a while to forgive Brad Whitford for Josh Lyman, but I did, since apparently I'm now calling him Brad Whitford, like we know each other. I hate it when people do that. Sorry, Bradley Whitford, sir. So it was a circuitous journey, but what I arrived at was Pablo Schreiber as William Lewis on Law & Order SVU. He actually was quite good in this role, which was annoyingly recurring as like Olivia Benson's literal hand-to-hand combat nemesis. She eventually killed him. It's not a spoiler. It happened like 4 years ago. And yet he kept coming back. Flashbacks that everybody could learn a very important lesson about PTSD. Nothing that happened here was really his fault. And it's not like I revered this person anyway, but he is burnt to a crisp after that SVU turn. I just can't with that guy anymore. Danny.
I had to think about this one for a while too. And then I realized that in our household, my wife and daughter are doing a Friends rewatch that I am sometimes around for. Uh-oh. And if you had asked me at the time that Friends was on this question, and I had to pick somebody from Friends, I think the answer would have been Phoebe Buffay. And it's not that Phoebe Buffay herself was so annoying. She was flaky, but she was one of those characters who audiences love. But if you knew this person in real life, you would find them maddening and you would do everything that you could to avoid them because she's so flaky. Mm-hmm. Now, 15 years later, looking back on it, Lisa Kudrow's great. I've never really had any problem forgetting Phoebe and stuff that she's done. Same thing with Jennifer Aniston. We recently watched The Morning Show on Apple TV and thought she was really good on that. And then I realized who it is that I feel this way about, and it is Ross Geller, played mm-hmm. by David Schwimmer, because as the series wore on, I found Ross Geller more and more annoying because he was always sort of the dad of the group. I find him so unlikable towards the end. And I remember that towards the end of Friends run, David Schwimmer was on Band of Brothers. He was some sort of lieutenant. And I seem to remember him trying to be a hard ass. And I just thought, he's just Lieutenant Ross. Like, is he gonna marry one of the Band of Brothers and then divorce him?
Wedding Band of Brothers.
Nice.
We were on a ceasefire.
He did show up on the American Crime Story about O.J. Simpson, and maybe it's the time that's spent since then. I seem to remember he wasn't too bad, but I still had a problem separating him from Ross. And so, Ross Geller, David Schwimmer.
I think the other thing they should do is they should have a deep fake series where they take Ross doing the lower hand motion thing from Friends, and like have every other character he did just do it in context of whatever that show was.
Do it in the courtroom on American Crime Story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
OJ.
Sure.
Yeah. Like the battlefield. Like he's like Germans are shooting at him. He's like, down, down. I think this could be sponsored by Mandyville, the Mandy from West Wing, who everybody hated and just disappeared from existence. Yeah. I think that was like one of those cases where the viewership made it reality. And that actress, Moira Kelly, just like, like, never really seen in any considerable way again.
She was on One Tree Hill, but yes. Yeah.
This is like not the greatest topic for me because I don't really have that connection. Like if somebody's a real dick, I'm fine with them as an actor. Like I think an answer a lot of people would say for this would be something like Joffrey from Game of Thrones or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like more power to him for being such a colossal, awesome dick, spoiled brat villain, right? Like I'm happy to see you do something else. I hope you don't get typecast. So I was trying to think of somebody who I feel like the character was at one level, but I think the actor brought in like something about it that left a bad taste in your mouth. And the one I settled on is Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother.
Good one.
Because the character isn't the greatest, but I think that actor brought a level of smugness to it that I don't think was necessarily written in and therefore lowered the whole thing down to the floor where it could have been a little lighter. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm following that guy's career closely, but there was that singing rise. Like, who cares? Like, it just seemed like the wrong choice for that. Mm-hmm. Like, for anything inspirational, it's just like, really? That guy? Ted Mosby? No. Like, this is the time we'll actually join track and field instead. Like, Yikes. So that's my choice. Ted Mosby, I think, ruined that guy. But I think like he ruined it too. So it's not it's sort of a cheat answer, but that's the closest I'm going to get to it.
Josh Radnor.
Thank you. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Tara Ariano.
It's true. We have talked about Big Mouth as a lead topic before, but for those who didn't hear that one, it's an animated series about middle school kids going through puberty. As such, its subject matter is generally pretty earthy. Characters are having their first kisses, getting their first periods, worrying that they're developing more slowly than their peers, learning how harmful it is to spread rumors about other people's private lives, ODing on online porn, fucking pillows, and so on. Through it all, certain characters are assisted or hindered by their hormone monsters, furry, intermittently visible creatures who watch over them and advise them about the changes they're going through. The show does not shy away from the hairs and fluids that characterize this moment in a person's life. So that, plus the outlandish imaginary characters, might obscure the real heart Big Mouth has, not just for its characters, but for the awkward goobers we all were once before we totally figured out our lives and became perfectly functional adults with no problems at all. I Survived Jesse's Bat Mitzvah, episode 9 of the show's first season, revolves around the momentous rite of passage in its title. Lots of Jewish comedians have commented on how cruel it is to put any 13-year-old child at the center of attention in the way a bar or bat mitzvah does, but Jesse's not the only one having a hard time. Here's why I think it deserves a place in the canon. Number one, it highlights all the kids' relationships with their parents. Obviously, a huge part of the appeal of Big Mouth is seeing little kid characters, voiced by adults, say and do extremely raunchy shit. But when you're in middle school, that means you're spending a lot of time with your parents in a lot of different moods and modes. Thoughtfully exploring the tensions of parent-child relationships during puberty is one of many ways the show stays grounded in reality. Coming off an episode where things went too far at a house party thrown by Nick's two older teen siblings, Missy, Jenny Slate, and Andrew, John Mulaney, are ordered by their parents to stay apart, which at first only makes them hornier for each other. But while Andrew strains to defy his parents, going all in by telling Missy how he envisions their future marriage together and telling her he loves her, she realizes they are going too fast and that their parents were right. We also see Nick Kroll, pulling away from his mother, Diane, Maya Rudolph, shortening their bedtime routine, asking her to call him Nick instead of Nikki, pushing his luck by calling her by her first name, which she does not allow. But when Jason Mantzoukas, steps in to take all the mothering Diane wants to give, Nick gets jealous and comes to realize how much he still needs Diane. As for Jay and his parents, let's not quote Jay's dad's law commercials, but they are not great, and this episode addresses that too. Number two, it portrays the end of Jesse's parents' marriage with empathy for everyone. A couple of episodes earlier, Nick and Andrew snuck out to New York City and happened to see Jesse's mother, Shannon, Jessica Chaffin, on the street, kissing another woman. But finding out about this indiscretion only sharpened Jesse's perception of the low-grade acrimony between her mother and her father, Greg, Seth Morris. Now, on the eve of the bat mitzvah, Jesse has an ever-lengthening list of things to stress out about. Clip one.
I can't believe my mom. She kisses some lady on the street and now she's being mean to Dad?
That is fucked up!
But who is the lighter?
I don't know. I never even thought about that.
The party is tomorrow! We all know that? Everyone knows that?
Guys, stop yelling!
Honey, we're not yelling. We're discussing the logistics for the best day of your life.
Best day of your life? Ha! Your parents keep fighting? You got a big old pimple parka lighting on your forehead? And crooked Shannon forced you to buy that dress that makes your torso look boxy.
You don't like the dress?
It doesn't work! It never worked!
The day of the bat mitzvah, Jesse isn't quite sure why cantor Dina, Michaela Watkins, is hovering around so much. Clip two.
Hey, Jess.
Hey, cantor Dina.
Wow! Really good vibes in this room. Yes! FYI, we're going to begin the journey in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Or as we say in the theater, thank you, five.
Okay.
And you have to say it back to me.
Thank you, five?
Shalom!
Did I pick this episode in part because of a thank you five joke? Maybe. Later during the ceremony, Jesse's hormone monster, Connie, Maya Rudolph again, lets Jesse know she's not a fan of cantor Dina. Clip three.
I don't know what it is, but I do not like that woman.
And it's been a real Simcha, right, Jess?
She's the worst. I hate how she hucks her words.
She should shut the fuck up.
It is during Shannon and Cantordina's notably long hug that Jesse figures out their new connection, including that it was Cantordina with whom Shannon was spotted in New York. She can't figure out what to do with this realization until the party, when getting hoisted up on a chair for the horror sends her into a highlight reel of her parents' increasingly unhappy life together. Clip 4.
Open up, jelly bean.
Babe.
Oh, come on. Jesse, your parents are very much in love. You'll just have to get used to that.
Oh, babe, I was going to watch a Sublime documentary tonight.
It's just one client dinner, 2 hours, and can you not?
You got it. I'll just practice Santeria some other time.
My dad was a lemon.
My dad was a purple.
Actually, your dad is a lemon.
Okay, Shannon.
Okay, Greg. Put me down. Please put me down!
Jesse gets Shannon alone outside to confront her about Pastordina, Cantordina. Neither of them noticing that Greg is on the other side of the deck, hearing about Shannon's infidelity for the first time. But they can't get into it because DJ Coach Steve, Nick Kroll again, calls them in for speeches. Clip 5.
Jesse, you were so amazing today. You really did Eleanor Roosevelt proud. She did, didn't she?
Shannon, can I see the mic for a second?
Greg, we agreed I would speak.
Oh, we agreed on a lot of stuff. Gimme, gimme, just gimme.
Don't worry, Daddy. I got 2 mics.
Oh, Jesus.
Jesus? Not in this house of worship. Am I right? Honestly, am I right? I don't know the different ones.
Jellybean. You've grown up so fast. It's like one of those internet videos, you know, where they take a picture every day, you know, a different picture every day, and you show them together real fast, and it looks like the guy, like, grows a beard right in front of you.
Greg?
I remember when we brought you home. We were so happy. But things are so different now. I mean, not necessarily worse, but when we talk about, yeah, they're worse. Right, Shannon? You made it worse.
Greg, please give me the mic.
It's my turn to talk.
Chill, Greg. Don't tell my dad to chill.
Yeah, shove it up your canter ass, Cantordina.
Greg, that is uncalled for.
Can everyone please stop saying my name like that? Like I'm some kind of maniac?
Then stop acting like one, Greg!
Oh, boy.
The progression through the plot line is so considered. It brings the viewer inside Jesse's mindset and recreates that helpless, queasy feeling that you get when you're a kid and your parents fight. But everything that happens after the confrontation is important, too. Shannon is caught and embarrassed, but, like the show's kid protagonists, is also going through changes and not sure what to do now. Greg may be a stoner fuck-up, but he sincerely loves Jesse and couldn't have the capacity to understand what Shannon was grappling with if she still can't even quite articulate it herself. Divorcing parents are a staple of young adult stories, even stories about young adults that are really for old adults, as Big Mouth is. But this one lets all three members of the Glazer family keep their dignity, another instance of the show staying grounded amidst all the absurdity. Point number 3, all the absurdity. The episode covers heavy shit, it's true. But the reason I keep calling out moments that keep the show grounded is because they appear among such ridiculous flights of fancy. Take, for instance, a plate of scallops, or if you're Andrew's dad, Marty, Richard Kind, don't, because if you eat them, they will give you diarrhea. But what mere mortal could resist this seduction? Clip 6.
Marty.
It's us, Marty.
Have a taste. You know you love our texture.
Stop that, please, all of you. I'm married for Christ's sakes, and these are new shoes.
Rockport, 9.5, extra wide.
Ooh, that's right. Enough to keep 8 packs of Rolaids in. You know me so well.
Hey, why don't you meet us at the dumpster after cocktail hour? You won't regret it.
Oh.
Marty may not go through with eating those scallops out of the trash, but we can't be sure that they won't induce him to buy a Mercedes or get his taxes done at H&R Block because, yes, that is John Hamm playing the Scallop Collective. Did that casting choice plus the Thank You 5 joke put this episode ahead of the rest for me? I'm not saying. As Elena did for her quinces on One Day at a Time, Jesse has themed the tables for extraordinary women. I don't see an Ava Perón tribute, but we do get this. Clip 7.
Who the hell is Malala?
She's just this girl who got shot in the face because she read a book and now she's super famous.
Lucky Malala?
That's what they call her.
The bat mitzvah wraps up with a Big Mouth hallmark. a somewhat depressing earworm. Clip 8.
Never share your feelings or life will kick you in the face.
Sometimes everything moves so fast you throw up all over the place.
Children grow up and abandon you to die broken and alone.
Scallops take you to paradise, but your asshole will atone.
In misery, no one is truly happy,
and it doesn't get any better when you're dead.
Big Mouth is an important title in Netflix's pantheon of youthful angst, and in bringing all the characters together for a big blowout event, I Survived Jesse's Bat Mitzvah also brings in a lot of the themes that make it such a strong show. I hope you will agree and induct it into the canon. Danny picked it off the list, so he should go first.
Okay. Dan.
I knew that John Hamm as the Scallops was going to make an appearance in your canon presentation. I didn't doubt that for a second. And it's one of the reasons why I love this episode. The episode is very typical of the series as a whole. It's one of our favorite shows of the last few years, I would say, from the jokes to the musical number, and some of those are more successful than others, but this, as you said, is an absolute earworm. Like, hours after we rewatch the episode, I'm humming. there's so much about the show that it gets right about this time. The, you know, that cusp between being a kid and being and wanting to be grown up, but then when you sort of get an understanding of what being grown up entails, you want to pull back a little bit. It's such a good show that my wife and I have been discussing, you know, when do we let our daughter watch this show? And it's so profane and so sexual a lot of the time that I find myself pulling back, even though I think there's a lot of good stuff in there for her to consider and think about. But it's also the kind of show where I don't think either of us wants to be in the position where we're watching it together. I think that would be uncomfortable for both of us. Because I remember like watching Degrassi Junior High when I was my daughter's age, and occasionally my parents would be like, well, we should probably watch this with him. And then if there are issues, we can discuss it. And it was just horrible.
Yeah.
So it's not something that I want to go through with her or put her through, but and it was fun to go back to this episode too. As the show has progressed, it's still funny, it's still great, but I've felt in recent seasons that there seems to be a thought on part of the show's producers that there's a checklist of capital I issues that they need to check off, that they need to address from episode to episode, instead of necessarily just worrying about a plot and worrying about the jokes and let everything else come as it comes. This episode is fantastic. Jesse's dad vaping on the deck when he finds out that that his wife was unfaithful, and that realization on Jesse's part. My parents are still together, but I thought this did a good job of recognizing that, yeah, Jesse's mom and kissed another woman, and Jesse's been blaming her for that for so long, but you do understand that Greg has not been an equal partner in their relationship for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And it's not one event that undoes a relationship. There's just so much to like about this episode. And I guess I'm telegraphing how I'm going to vote, but I think this was an excellent choice.
Oh, thank you.
Sarah.
I really liked this episode. I watched the first season and then stopped because I felt like, I don't know. I know that some people tend to sort of seize on Maya Rudolph's performance here as, and like quote it in conversation. And I don't love it. I don't love what she's doing as the hormone monstrous. I think it's like, and part of that is the same reason that I don't watch South Park. Like, it's physically like painful, the tamper to me. I don't know what that is. They should come up with a diagnostic name for that, so that when people ask me if I've kept watching South Park, I can be like, nope, like auditory somethingosis. Anyway, but I really thought that this episode was, it's right on that line. Like, it's really funny and scatological and gross and gee, thanks for picking an episode in which even cartoon barf is on my favorite. And there it is, memorialized forever in a photo booth strip. But they also did like that montage of her during the horror realizing that her parents, like her parents' marriage has basically collapsed under the weight of like a thousand pebbles over the years, that I thought that was really well done, and not, there was sentiment, like it was felt, but it wasn't sentimental.
Yeah.
So maybe I need to take another run at this show and in later seasons, although I think like sometimes it's a little in love with certain characters and thinks they're funnier than they are, but oh my God, the scallops, like every time you hear the John Hamm Mercedes commercials, and the latest iteration is a really pretty barfy self-congratulatory, here at Mercedes, you know, we're continuing to make Mercedeses, like cool story, bros. And he has to, you know, read this copy like that's like Mercedes is God's gift to its own earth. But then he will do shit like this, just like cheerfully, that he's a whole plate of scallops trying to lure a middle-aged man into getting diarrhea. Like, you have to respect that. And I do. So yeah, this was fun to revisit, and I'd sort of put Big Mouth on my list of like, I tried that and I don't think it's entirely for me, but I don't know. I don't mind moving things off that list, certainly. Now that I'm not watching Killing Eve, look at all this free time. So yeah, an excellent presentation as well. You. Dave.
I take your point about the show sometimes being very pleased with itself about certain things that kind of land with a thud. And in this episode, it's the small Jewish penis of the hormone monster. Is in it like three times, and each time it comes up, you're like, it's just like energy down.
Or Duke Ellington.
I'm always getting trouble when I say this, but I feel like he's like the Gene is to Bob's Burgers as Duke Ellington is to Big Mouth. Sometimes you feel like they just need something to literally jazz up a scene, and it's like, well, let's throw some Duke stuff in there, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's part of the plot, but other times he just seems to be like, well, it's time for a zing, you know, and here he comes. What do you think? This is addressing everybody. John Hamm roles where he is inanimate talking things. Which one was better? Plate of scallops or talking toilet?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
He has more to do in talking toilet.
But he has more depth and more emotion. He brings more passion to the plate of scallops, I think.
I certainly felt more seduced by Big Mouth John Hamm than I did the toilet from Bob's Burgers.
Yeah.
Among us.
Yeah, Big Mouth has episodes. I think obviously there's episodes of Big Mouth that have more laughs in this episode, but this episode is really great in that it marries the two things that Big Mouth does really well, which is that Tina Belcher-esque, oh yeah, I remember what this was like as a kid, oh my God, the horror, and actually funny jokes, where Bob's Burgers is your network funny jokes. Big Mouth gets to let loose and have at it, so they hit a little harder, grosser, they're everything more, and yeah. A lot of, you know, that's what the hook of Big Mouth was when it started. It's just like, oh, there's all these kids and they're talking about puberty and sex, and oh my God, that it's like all these disgusting things are happening. There's a kid who's fucking a pillow. So this episode is great because I think it is funny at parts. The second half funnier than the first half, but the first half more touching than the second half. So I feel like it marries everything without being whiplashy. And the John Hamm scallops is like one of the funniest things on Big Mouth ever. Like, it killed me the first time I saw it. And it made me smile the second time. I know it probably didn't happen this way, but I'd love to imagine Richard Kind and John Hamm in the studio booth together doing that scene.
Yeah.
And just having the fucking time of their life, right? You know?
Yeah.
Don't tell me if you know.
Who cares?
That's what happened.
Yeah.
So this was great. I love the line, for some reason, cracked me up. As you wish, my boxy Jewess. Was just like, what a weird line. Just, and it worked. So yeah, great choice. Funnier episodes, yes, but this is like the perfect mix that Big Mouth brings. So
well done.
So let's put this to the official vote. Mr. Danny McEachern, what say you?
speaking at a time in my life where I'm more Richard Kind as Marty than John Mulaney as Andrew, it's a big yes for me.
So you had diarrhea last night? Sorry, Sam.
He's wearing 9.5 extra wide Rockports as he recorded this.
Sarah D. Bunting?
I forgot to note our man Kinas, staff writer on this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Gold. Yep. Gold Jerry. Yeah, that's a yes for me.
Yeah, me too. So that means... That means that Big Mouth Season 1, Episode 9, I Survived Jesse's Bat Mitzvah. You are hereby inducted into the extra. I break in.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara has the winner.
Well, I do have the winner. I assume you'll have thoughts. The winner is The Mandalorian, because among the many announcements of the various guest stars that they have cast for season 2, Timothy Olyphant.
Timothy. Off with his helmet.
Yes, thank you. Setting me up for the thing I was going to say, which is if they do a fucking Pedro Pascal and have him in a dumb helmet for the whole time he's on the show, and then they just take it off for 1 second, I'll be really pissed. But even if they do, bullshit. I will know if it's just like him voicing it and someone else walking around, because Timothy Olyphant has a weird walk and we all know what it looks like. Dave, your thoughts on this casting?
I can tell you what to expect, but I got to go into spoiler territory.
All right.
Okay.
Spoilers ahoy.
So it's been semi-confirmed or all but confirmed that Timothy Olyphant is wearing the Boba Fett armor on set. But he is not Boba Fett, because we know Boba Fett is the guy who's Aquaman's dad, whose name I forget, that actor.
Oh, right. Yes, I know it too. Yes. Oh,
it'll come to us.
I will look.
And because we saw in the Star Wars prequels that Boba Fett is a clone and they all look like that guy.
Temuera Morrison.
Yes. So he can't actually be Boba Fett, but in the greater canon, that is, like, it didn't happen in the movies, but here all this other stuff,
the
in books and comics and stuff. There is this character named Cobb Vanth.
Oh my God.
As in Cobb Salad.
Okay.
Who,
Lord,
comes across Boba Fett's armor.
Mm-hmm.
How'd he get the armor? Did he get it out of the Sarlacc pit and he just like discarded it because it was all pitted with acid and stuff like that? That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
So he steals the armor, basically takes it, whatever, and becomes sort of a self-appointed sheriff of this little town on Tatooine.
Mm-hmm.
There was one episode of The Mandalorian season 1, the one with the ER lady actor, Ming.
Oh, Ming-Na.
Ming-Na. Thank you. Where at the end of it, somebody comes up to her with jingly jangly spur boots. And that's what Boba Fett sounded like in The Empire Strikes Back. You can hear him. He actually has spurs on his boots. Mm-hmm. So everybody's thinking, oh, that's Boba Fett. But actually, it could have been this guy, good old Cobb, because he was the one who possibly found all of Boba Fett's armor. Mm-hmm. So anyways, Timothy Olyphant could be playing a guy that looks like Boba Fett, but actually is not Boba Fett. Into the Land, Orion, season 2.
Cobb Vanth.
Cobb
Vanth Refrigeration.
Yes. And Loser of the Week?
Well, this is not confined to this week, but these events are specific to this week. Brian Austin Green.
Buddy.
Always a loser. But the latest loserishness, besides him being a deadbeat dad to his kids with Vanessa Marsil, no,
allegedly,
I'm not going to fucking let that drop, is that he is getting cucked by Machine Gun Kelly. Who? Temporary host of Catfish who looks 14, Machine Gun Kelly? That's the dude.
Yep.
So his response to this was twofold. A, he posted a weird butterfly message about it on Instagram, in which he said basically that butterflies are free and it's not their fault if they want to flap away from you and your deadbeat dadness because you suck.
You're paraphrasing slightly.
Only slightly.
Only slightly.
Then he went on his podcast. Why does he have a podcast?
He has a podcast.
Everyone has a podcast. And basically was like, I don't want anyone to take sides and I don't blame Kelly and everything's cool between us and we're on a break. And he said that, I guess, Megan Fox came home from whatever bullshitty movie that, based on the title, Tara and I were theorizing today, she like made this up to get away from Brian Austin Green. And there's no such movie. But she came home and was like, you know, I just like myself better as a person when I'm out of town on location and working. And it's like, if this is what he said to his podcast listeners, imagine how salty what he actually was told was.
Yeah.
So yeah, Brian Austin Green, chicken coming home to roost and shitting all over him.
Yeah, the movie is called Midnight in the Switchgrass, which is some fake ass tax credits getting like.
Yeah, that's no. She made that up and like dummied up some call sheets and was like, I'm just going to go sit in a, you know, at a spa in Vancouver, BC for like 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking about sitting somewhere for 8 weeks and contemplating your mistakes, do you know what time it is?
Switchgrass time.
Jeez.
Game time. Welcome back, everybody, to another Game Time. This is the third Game Time of the season. Season scores are, get this, value guess 2. Tara and Sarah, 0.
Dope. It's a lot of pressure on me.
It is a lot of pressure. Better not screw up. Today we are playing Butlerfield Earth from Elon Muscat, who earns himself an extra credit topic. I have been hankering for some straight trivia lately, so today we are playing Butlerfield Earth. I will give you an employer from television. You give me the butler, housekeeper, etc. under their employ. 2 points if you can get it right away from the employer. If you need a hint, I will give you that in form of the show involved. Your task is to name the character's name, who plays the butler or what have you. That's all there is to it. We have 27 questions for you today, plus 2 Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zones. Tara Ariano, can I get the stimulus situation, please?
Yes. Sarah D. Bunting, I regret to say, has 0. I also have 0, but I do have an extravaganza gong. Valued guest, in this case, Danny McEachern, has 1 steel meal. Danny, you know what a steel meal is.
I know what a steel meal is.
All right.
Let's throw it to Pinky to see who is going first.
We will start with Tara.
Tara, Danny, Sarah is our order today. Are we ready to play Butlerfield Earth?
Ready as I'm going to be.
Here we go. First question to Tara.
Yes.
You must name the butler as employed by Judge Philip Banks.
Oh my God, what was his name? I want to say Carlton, but I know that's not right. He was English. Jeffrey. Ugh.
Good for 2 points. That show was
The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Correct. To Danny, we want the butler of Lord Crawley.
Okay, so this is Downton Abbey, and the butler, oh my gosh. Okay, so the hint's not going to help me, so I got to try to pull the name. Can I name any servant on Downton Abbey, or just the main?
I said the butler. There's 1 butler.
It's, God, I'm going to kill myself when.
It's not Sarah Bunting.
No. What's she doing here? I mean, I can remember that, but one of the main characters on the show, I'm having trouble coming up with the name. Forget it. I can't get it.
That is, and everybody?
Mr. Carson.
Carson, correct.
Carson!
All right, Sarah, Governor Eugene X. Gatling.
Oh, thanks, Picky. That's Benson of Benson.
Correct.
Benson.
Right. It would have been awful if you did not get that one.
The employer is Scrooge McDuck.
Who is his butler? I don't know who his butler was. That doesn't. I know it's DuckTales. That doesn't help me.
It is DuckTales, and even though he is a dog of some kind, his name is Duckworth.
Okay.
Duckworth. Mm. Back to Danny.
Yep.
Maxwell Sheffield is the employer. Who was in his employ?
Maxwell Sheffield.
You can guess out the gate. Ask for the hint.
Well, okay. I'm not going to come up with the name. I'm going to ask for the hint, but I think this sounds like it's The Nanny. What's the name of the show?
The Nanny. So you kind of have 2 answers here that you can...
Can I just say The Nanny?
No. That's not the character's name.
Well, unless the character's name is Fran, I'm not going to get it. So let's say Fran.
We'll accept
that.
Hey! The other one we accepted was Niles. Niles.
Oh, okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. The employer is Princess Bubblegum.
Princess Bubblegum. Hint, please.
Princess Bubblegum is on Adventure Time.
That does not help me, so... And I can't say Benson. Jake.
Peppermint Butler. Peppermint Butler.
Oh, yeah. Not back in a million Tara. Years.
Kind of an easy one. The employer, Bruce Wayne.
Alfred.
Alfred.
Alfred Pennyworth.
Thank you. To Danny. Birdie Wooster.
Birdie Wooster, I believe that would be Jeeves.
You are correct. Sarah D. Bunting. Nicholas with a K. Cassadine.
Nicholas Cassadine? I mean, the hint isn't really going to help, but it'll buy me some time. So hint, please.
Your hint is General Hospital.
No, that does not really help me. Let's say Lucy Coe, just for fun.
That is another Alfred. Another Alfred.
Okay.
Tara Ariano.
Yeah.
The employer, George Owens.
Oh, I don't know who George Owens is, so tell me the show, please.
The show is Mr. Belvedere.
Oh.
So, here's the trick.
I feel like I've sat on my own balls this one. Is it Mr. Belvedere?
It's Mr. Belvedere. Do you know the first name? Because I think you should know it because of cross trivia from this and other shows that we enjoy.
Yeah. I know the actor's
name. I'm
going
to give you the point.
Okay, but. I know the actor's name, but I don't know his first name.
The first name, Lynn.
I do.
Oh.
Lynn.
Danny knew it.
I know what his middle name is, too.
What is it?
Aloysius.
Wow.
2 day points for by the guest.
Okay.
All right, Danny.
Yes, sir.
This is, as you know, randomized question. So this is just the way it landed. Your employer, Cinnamon J. Scudworth.
Oh, excellent. There's a nice little 2-point layup. That would be Mr. Butlertron.
Mr. Butlertron. First name?
Wesley. I don't know what his first name is.
Lynn.
It's Lynn.
What?
All right, this will take us to our first score break. It is for Sarah Bunting. Your employer, asterisk, Martin Crane. Doesn't pay the bills, but...
Martin Crane. Fuck. Daphne?
Nice!
Correct.
There
physical
you go.
Therapist and kind of housekeeper, maker of meals. All right, let's hear Dem scores.
Very, very close game. Danny and I are tied with 5 points each. Sarah D. Bunting barely behind with 4 points. Could change everything.
Equalize me.
The Adam Grossworth equalizer.
Challenge zone.
Come on, we rehearse that.
Clearly.
All right, you know the score, Sarah.
Good luck.
Starting you off with classics.
Thank you.
What military outfit's public service program was titled The Big Picture?
What military program's public service?
Yeah. What branch of the military had that as their PSAE sort of thing, I guess?
Oh. Well, the Army.
The Army is, in fact... Correct.
Hey.
Sitcoms. Whose house was between the Lorenzos and the Jeffersons?
Oh, God. I can, like, picture this actor and I don't remember the name. The Bensons.
Archie Bunker.
Oh, right.
What did St. Elsewhere's Dr. Wendy Armstrong do after writing the note, "Why must life always begin tomorrow"?
Took her own life.
Made it suicide, correct. All right, 3 questions left. You only need one of them. Kids and Games. Who couldn't hack it as the host of a 1980 revival of You Bet Your Life?
Buddy Hackett?
Fuck me.
Wow!
Did you hear the eye roll when I flipped the card over and looked for the answer? Is that what gave it away?
Yes. It was an audible creak.
Yeah. Update of scores, please, John.
Well, Danny and I are still tied with 5 points each, but now Sarah is in the lead with 8.
All right. Very good. Getting back to the game. Tara.
Yes.
The employer is the Jeffersons.
Oh, my God. Florence.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Florence Johnson. Danny.
Yes, sir.
The employer, the Prince of Wales, Georgie.
Prince of Wales.
Georgie. Prince of Wales.
Hint, please.
We are talking about Blackadder the Third.
I'm just going to guess. Let's say Jeeves again.
That was, in fact, Blackadder.
Oh, God. Fine.
Sarah D. Bunting. Stan and Jill Pembroke. Stan and Jill Pembroke.
Pembroke.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got nothing. Hint?
All right, this is going to give it away. Maybe, I don't know. Let's find out. Your show, Charles in Charge.
Charles.
Correct. No last name on Charles ever given, apparently.
Really?
Always just known as Charles.
Huh.
Tara.
Yeah.
Your employer, Howard Stark.
Okay. This is Agent Carter. So I think this is Jarvis.
Jarvis. Edwin Jarvis is correct. 2 points.
Nice.
Good job.
This is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
It is for Danny. Britt Reed. Britt Reed is the employer.
Britt Reed is the employer. That name's not ringing any bells, so I will take a hint, please.
Now the show, The Green Hornet.
Oh, okay. Well, then I guess I'm going to guess that this was Cato.
Cato the chauffeur. Correct. 1 point. To Sarah D. Bunting, the employer, Mr. Gomez Adams.
You rang. I think that's Lurch.
It is Lurch. Good for two. We are now at question. It is for Tara. Tara, your employer is Jonathan Hart.
Oh, no. Well, this is Heart to Heart, but I don't remember what the guy's name was.
Mentioned in the credits, I believe.
Yes. Max? Shit.
Oh, you got it.
Nice.
Nicely done.
Wow.
Mr. McEachern. Waxana Troy.
Troy, that sounds like Star Trek, a show which I am not overly familiar with, is... well, we can't guess, right?
You can guess. Yeah, you're allowed to. That's the whole point. Can't answer if you don't guess.
No, no, no. What I mean is,
I know what you mean. I'm being difficult.
It doesn't sound like you did.
Yeah, you get one answer.
I know.
Well, I know it's Star Trek: The Next Generation, or at least if it's not, I have no idea what it is, and I need a couple points. So, I don't even know if this guy's a butler or what, but I'm going to say Data.
Very insulting,
Mr. Hom. The big, well, big
it was,
dude.
It was Star Trek The Next Generation, though, right?
Yes, it was.
It was. Yeah. He was basically okay. Lurch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that guy, same guy played Lurch in the movie, I think.
Space Lurch.
Yep. All right, this will bring us to our second score break. It is for Sarah D. Bunting. Huh. Chester and Jessica Tate are the employers. Two possible answers here.
Chester and Jessica Tate? I don't think the hint is going to help, but I'll ask for the hint anyway.
Okay. Before I give you the hint, what do you think it is? Like the show?
I think it's soap.
It's soap.
Fuck. So you're not going to take actor names then? Wait, maybe I can pull one of these actor names. Hold on. It's like Jamie or Jesse or something like that. Let's try Jamie.
All right, everybody in the world, all together now. 1, 2, 3.
Benson!
Oh, Jesus. I always forget that he was on there. God damn it.
Scores, please, Tara.
All right. Once again, we have a tie. Now, Sarah and I are tied with 11 points each. Danny behind us with 6.
All right, Danny, here's your chance to catch right up with him in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge.
Good luck
indeed, Danny. Classics. What future sci-fi host wrote Requiem for a Heavyweight for Playhouse 90?
Sci-fi hosts. Well, the only person I can think of that would fit that would be Rod Serling.
Woo!
Well thought out.
Good start.
Sitcoms.
Yeah.
What was young Dennis Mitchell better known as in the title of an early 60s sitcom?
That's Dennis the Menace.
Drama. What Hollywood gossip queen did Elizabeth Taylor play in the biopic Malice in Wonderland? Good luck. Gossip queen.
I don't know. Kitty Kelly.
Good guess.
Luella Parsons.
Not
Kids and Games. You only need one of these next three questions. What baseballer hosted He Said, She Said, Sale of the Century, and Strike It Rich?
Baseball player hosted. I don't know. Bob Uecker.
Do you know this one, Sarah?
I don't. Might be Wes Farrell.
His first name's Joe.
Joe Garagiola?
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
Huh.
Charlie Brown's favorite.
Still got two left, Danny. Who played Morris Buttermaker? What a great name. Who played Morris Buttermaker in the sitcom version of The Bad News Bears? Morris Buttermaker.
Well, sitcom version. I don't know. I've seen the movie, but I've never seen the sitcom. I'm not sure I even knew there was a sitcom. I take it wasn't Walter Matthau, but I'm going to say Walter Matthau.
Replacing him was Jack Warden.
Huh.
All right, comes down to this wild card. You need it to get your points. Yeah. What percentage of U.S. homes had TV by 1990?
What percentage?
Yeah.
I hate 78, those questions.
88, or 98.
Like, you feel like everybody did, but 2% not having it seems like a lot. Because I feel like I went to college with every 2% people who did not have a TV and were all too happy to talk about at parties. Okay, well, I'm going to say 88%.
If 98 seemed low, then, you know, you should have won 98 because it was 98.
Sorry,
Danny. No. I thought 2% seemed low to not have a TV.
I see.
Like, I thought there would be more people than that who didn't have a TV. So 98% seemed too high to me. That's what I was thinking.
Okay, some of that new math for you. All right, getting back to it. Tara.
Yes.
Sterling Mallory Archer is the employer.
What's his? Okay, it's Archer. It's been so long since I've watched the show. I don't remember what his butler's name is.
Woodhouse.
Oh, no.
Danny.
Yes,
we are looking for the personal butler, something like that, for Mr. Montgomery Burns.
Oh, I feel like it's too late in the game now for this to do me much good, but that, of course, is Smithers.
Smithers. Correct for two. Sarah D. Bunting, who was in the employ of Mr. Michael Brady?
Oh, Alice.
Tara.
Yeah.
Last questions for everybody coming at you. Who was in the employ, two possible answers, of Basil Fawlty?
Manuel.
Or
Polly.
Correct. Only get your 2 points for that one.
Right.
But I'll give you a Dave point for your troubles.
All right.
Danny, your last question. We are looking for the help of one Mr. George Jetson.
Oh, God. George Jetson. Oh, another one that I'm going to kick myself after. Say Alice.
What's not? Anybody else know it?
Rosie?
Rosie the robot.
Rosie, of course.
All right, our last question of the game for Sarah, with a possible three answers, but probably only one you know. The employer is Mr. Drummond. Please let me know what TV show you think this is from.
Different Strokes.
2 day points for cooperation.
So, God, who worked for? I don't remember her character's name. Three different answers, you said?
Yeah, there were three. I'm trying not to give the answer.
Three people fulfilled this.
Thank you.
This yes. job.
Yes.
This occupation.
I see. Okay. Well, then I'm going to fold my hands in prayer and hope that one of them is Mrs. Garrett.
Yeah!
Oh,
correct. All right, that's the end of regulation. Scores at the end turn.
All right. Danny finished with 8 points. I had 13. Sarah D. Bunting is our victor with 15.
Nicely Woo! Done. All right, I have a tiebreaker. We'll okay. play it. First person to shout out the correct answer wins a steel meal.
Okay.
Are we ready, Tara?
Yes, sir.
Are we ready, Danny?
Yes.
Are we ready, Sarah?
Yes.
I will read the employer. You ramble me off the employee when you know it. Angela Bauer.
Tony Massari.
That is the quickest wow. tiebreaker answer we've had.
That's
easily.
Amazing. He easily. Had that in the chamber.
He did. That is a little
yeah.
scary.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It occurred to me that we hadn't had Angela yet, so.
Sarah.
Well Sarah. Done, Sarah. Well done, Danny, on that.
Thank you. Yes.
Semester.
Well done, everyone.
Indeed. Good game.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We ran around in a panic for Fox Summer Show Ultimate Tag before going around the dial with stops at Snowpiercer, Katie Keene, Call the Midwife, The Last Dance, Killing Eve, and Holy Moly. Mary asked us to name characters that ruined actors for us, while Tara's Big Mouth made the case for Big Mouth's Bat Mitzvah episode or the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from Elon. Next up on Friday, it's the Goop Lab Lab Part 1 on Extra Extra Hot Great, plus our last quarantine helper for now. And on the next Extra Hot Great Prime, it's Homecoming Season 2. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David D. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Arianna.
That's what they call her.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Thank you, Five.
And Daniel McEachern.
It's time to play some tag.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra. Not great.
Oh, I knew it was too good to be true.
It's worse than I thought. And I knew it was gonna end badly.
You did?
Of course, you're such a fucking dork.
I know.
Oh, come here. Oh.
Angela Bauer.
Tony Massari.